Please silence all electronic devices.
It was really fascinating, though. I mean, you're watching these stone faces. They're just looking back at you. They're all sort of scowling at you, and they're not mad. They're just concentrating really hard and just thinking this through and just, you know, analyzing it in their own way. And all of a sudden, you can almost see the light bulb go off when you made a connection and helped them understand some aspect of campaigning.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the northern reaches of Wake County, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks, as always, for downloading and clicking play. On this episode, a conversation about how the pandemic is impacting campaign efforts. And we're chatting with Jonathan Feltz. He's a well-known political strategist in Raleigh, but also has ties to Capitol Hill. He served in the George W. Bush administration. And we're going to chat about not only his political journey, but also what the pandemic means for candidate messaging, for fundraising, potentially for political rallies this fall. Is it going to be in any way a normal election cycle? So we're going to get to some of those things. But our conversation, which was recorded last week from our respective homes in Raleigh, begins with me asking him how the pandemic has affected his day-to-day. And I asked him for just a snapshot of what life has been like recently.
Well, so my wife and I, we both actually work from our homes already prior to the quarantine, the shelter in place. And so fortunately for us, we did not have a big adjustment as far as that goes. Now, what has been the big adjustment has been we have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they are no longer in daycare. They've been here at the house, and so we've had to make some adjustments there. And so that's been one of the big challenges right there.
If you dare just briefly venture into it, a best and a worst part of the last 2.5 months for you?
The worst part has been, candidly, a lot of what I do depends on a lot of networking, being out and about and seeing people. A lot of times people don't proactively think to call me, but when they see me somewhere, they say, oh, I've got this issue, you can help, let me call you tomorrow. And that's how I do a lot of my business development. So that's been a challenge. One of the best parts has been, not to be the dad cliche here, but just, I have been spending some more time with my children. That's been enjoyable. My oldest, he is not overly adventuresome sometimes, and so his bicycle had been sitting barely touched since Christmas, but given that we've not had a lot to do other than go for our family walks, he's become quite the little daredevil on the bike. So it's been fun watching that evolvement on his part.
So the pandemic, I think, has upended just most, if not seemingly all, kind of rhythms and routines in our lives, and that would include political campaigns. I want to start there, just with maybe basic functions and practices of campaigns. And I'm wondering, as you know, we head into June here, what stands out to being most different right now to you, relative to how things would normally be at this point in an election cycle of a major election year?
At this point in a campaign cycle, traditionally, both parties have their nominees firmly in place. And people really start pivoting back to, back to the center in a lot of ways. There was the famous Etch-a-Sketch comment made by a Mitt Romney advisor back in 2012, how they were going to shake the Etch-a-Sketch and kind of recreate the candidate after the primary, moving back towards the center after taking, right-wing views or left-wing views, depending on your party. And so you're not seeing that the way you traditionally would, because both camps are so firmly entrenched and, they've made the pandemic political already. And, candidly, the way our political environment is right now, anyone working for compromise, that's not necessarily a good way to campaign right now, because the base is holding people so their feet to the fire so much on you've got to pick a side, and working in the middle isn't necessarily something that's good politics. The other big thing that's missing right now, this is the busiest time every 4 years, both for people that own the advanced teams, but also on the Secret Service. They're always pulling in former agents who will transfer maybe to DHS and some of the other security branches in the federal government, pulling them back in for protective detail because there's so many events. And, of course, you're not seeing that at all right now.
Are we going to see political rallies this fall? What do you think?
I predict that we will, if for no other reason than our president is very focused on that. I mean, that is something he generally gets a lot of energy from. I think that's an important part of his campaign structure. And that's been one of the big challenges that he has had to look at. More so even than what Joe Biden has to deal with. Traditionally a challenger, you want to find a lot of energy. You want to get out and do these big rallies to show how strong your candidacy is. But in the case of Trump, I think he really thrives on those rallies. And the cutting-edge technology they were using to identify people at the rallies, to get people to the rallies, to identify new supporters. You know, every time there was a rally, they were talking about these people were people who didn't vote for the president 4 years ago or maybe just didn't vote at all. They're now on board Team Trump. And they were really able to capture a lot of data for supporters and really do a lot of outreach through those rallies. And so I know he's missing those a great deal, and he seems really fixated on doing that. And so I think he's certainly going to try as hard as he can to do the rallies.
We could probably spend half an hour on the effects on the candidates, effects on campaigns, effects on voter habits, voter beliefs, effects on whether or not they're going to be rallies. So we can get into some of those. I'm interested to hear from you, I guess, specifically because money is central to all elections at this point. And it's an important undercurrent, if not one of the most important undercurrents and themes of any successful candidacy or campaign. What have you observed over the last 2+ months here about how campaign fundraising is or is not taking place and what the impacts and effects of the pandemic have been on that side of 2020?
Well, I think we're not really going to see the true impact of this on fundraising until probably the next quarter when those reports come out. You know, one of the biggest impacts they're going to have is the simple fact is a lot of major donors no longer have as much money as they did before this. I was talking to a donor who was considering the idea of funding a third-party operation earlier this year, and, you know, he was talking, you know, pretty significant contribution to this organization. And when I communicated with him after the pandemic struck, he talked about having went from making on average $4 million a year to making $1 million a year with his income stream. And so a lot of the major donors, their, you know, simple reality is they'll have less money. But for right now, honestly, it doesn't seem like it's had a big impact. It has been impacted in terms of how you raise the money. Folks having to spend a lot more time on the phones as opposed to doing the formal events. Some folks have tried to get really creative with the events. You've had everything from, you know, Zoom happy hours to special wine tastings to, I think, one Democrat out in California who was close to someone in the restaurant industry had a catered dinner as an option where the food would be delivered to your house and that, you know, ready, easy to prepare type setup. And then people would get on their Zoom conference call and ask questions of the candidate. And so you've seen some creativity that way. But the actual money coming in right now, there's not been a huge impact yet.
What other impacts or effects have you seen or are you anticipating?
The biggest impact obviously has been if you are an incumbent versus a challenger. You know, incumbents have a big platform they can work off of. Challengers do not. You've seen that here in North Carolina with Governor Cooper. He's on the air every single day doing a press conference as relates to the COVID-19 response. President Trump, for many weeks, was doing his, you know, nightly 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, hour to hour and a half telethon, it felt like, from the White House grounds, discussing his response to the COVID-19. And so if you're a chief executive, you've got a really big platform. If you're the challenger, in this case, you know, Dan Forrest, one of his challenges is that the governor controls the response. There's not a whole lot the lieutenant governor can do, and so that sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the room. In the case of Tom Tillis versus Cal Cunningham, I think this has been, and to be clear, I think every candidate running would prefer this have obviously never happened in any way, shape, or form. And they're really not, you know, they have to think about politics because it's a political year. But I think most people are committed to doing their jobs right now. And in the case of Tom Tillis, I think this has been good for him politically in that it's really allowed him to showcase his pragmatic leadership.
So Cooper has had a lot of this earned media, these daily briefings from members of his cabinet. And he's been on, I would say, consistently a couple times a week now. It seems as though the gap between he and Forrest, the presumptive Republican nominee, I guess we haven't had the formal state convention at this point, but the race between Cooper and Forrest is, you know, it appears as though it's widening in some ways. So push back and tell me if you disagree with that assessment. But if we're on the same page there, make the case for me for how Dan Forrest can overcome the earned media advantage that Cooper has been the beneficiary of here in recent weeks and kind of overcome that widening gap?
Sure, that's a totally a fair question. What I would say is a few things. First off, Dan Forrest, he's got a grassroots operation second to no one's. And so I think if Dan Forrest goes out across the state I honestly wouldn't spend a lot of time in Raleigh and Charlotte with the big media centers there. I would go to these, the other 98 counties and do a lot of outreach and talk about, you know, what Republicans have done in terms of regulatory reform. You know, what is the reason that North Carolina is going to be able to rebound better than a lot of states can from this economic disaster? It's going to be because of Republican policies that Republicans put in place dating back to 2011 when they took over. I think Danforth going out there and talking about how the regulatory reform vision that Republicans have, the economic growth vision that Republicans have, that's how we're going to rebound from this. I think that could be a good thing. And last but not least, Roy Cooper, he's in a great position right now. I don't know if he'll be in the same position with the after-action reports. You know, right now, what I'd say we're in the process when, you know, if you're ever on an airplane and you have to make an emergency landing, no one is standing up, hitting their flight attendant bell saying, I demand an answer on this. What is happening? Why are we doing this emergency landing? You're strapping on your seatbelt. You're, you know, probably saying a prayer to the big man upstairs. And you're as thankful as can be when you land safely. Now, if 4 or 5 hours later, you're still sitting on the tarmac and no one's giving you any information, you're starting to get upset with some justification, I might add. And then if you find out, lo and behold, the pilot made a mistake and overreacted, you might be a little upset about that. I think that, I mean, you're already seeing some articles where Democrats, national Democrats, including the Biden campaign, they're openly talking about, they have a fear about a economic resurgence in, you know, September or October, and they think that's bad politics for their candidates. And I think if you're Roy Cooper, you know, you are concerned about what the after-action reports are going to be. You know, we're looking at right here in North Carolina, not to diminish this in any way, shape, or form, but, you know, 63% of the fatalities have been in nursing facilities. I think some people are going to start asking, well, what steps did Roy Cooper take to help ensure the safety in our nursing home facilities and things like that? And that's, you know, and it could be that the after-action reports show that Roy Cooper did everything he was supposed to do. And in that case, that'll be a good thing for him. But that would be the things I'd be nervous about if I was Roy Cooper, and those are some of the ways forward for someone like Dan Forrest.
Toss-up in the Senate race, leaning Cooper's way in the gubernatorial contest. I want to ask you about the Republican National Convention and what you think the potential impact or the outcomes might be in a state where these things can be very tight, these races, if the RNC was to move from Charlotte or were to stay in Charlotte. Do you think that's something that could have an impact come early November, or probably not?
So my instinct is probably not. I think if you really don't like Donald Trump, you're going to think everything Donald Trump does is wrong anyway. And if you really like Donald Trump, you're going to blame Roy Cooper, or you're going to blame Roy Cooper, another Democrat, you know, call it what they're calling it, shutdown governors, and then the news media. So I think it would have more of a confirmation bias type issue more than anything else. That said, you know, all that is could change if there's a major health issue. If conventions are held and there's a huge spike, that could be traced back directly to the convention. Obviously, you know, any kind of large gathering, that's going to be an issue. But conversely, if they move the convention to, let's say, Georgia or Florida, and there's no issue whatsoever, you know, there will be some people asking some legitimate questions of the Cooper administration as to why they allowed that to happen.
Jonathan Feltz here on the WDONC Politics Podcast. He's a political strategist. Do you coin yourself a political strategist? Do you? I in a pre-call, I used the phrase political influencer, and I could tell you didn't love that. How do you size your role up in the North Carolina and larger political bubbles these days?
So I really spend more of my time on corporate communications or big public affairs campaigns. And, you know, corporate communications sometimes involves politics, sometimes not. But the public affairs campaigns always involves, you know, knowing the political intelligence, the political lay of the land, having a good situational awareness of who's up and who's down, for lack of a better term. And so so I would say one part corporate communications, one part political strategist.
You've had, for my money, an interesting political journey thus far. You were an advisor to President George W. Bush, as well as Vice President Cheney. You spent more than a year in Afghanistan. You've been a senior advisor to then-Governor Pat McCrory. And according to various sources, you began as a door-knocking, boot-working volunteer in New Hampshire. When did you start volunteering in New Hampshire, and whose candidacy got you your feet going up there?
Great question. Well, I've been very blessed with a lot of unique opportunities. was born and raised in Davie County, and I like to joke that my parents did not have a political Rolodex growing up. I don't think they had much of any Rolodex, to be honest with you. And so I started the old-fashioned way with volunteering full-time. But I had started doing informational interviews, you know, where you literally just call someone up who, you know, maybe it's a county party chairman, maybe it's someone who works in a Senate office, and just ask for their time to come in and pick their brain on how they got started. And it seemed pretty consistent that you needed to either get your parents to give $100,000 to a campaign or go volunteer somewhere free of charge. And so I didn't have the $100,000 check, so I called up a campaign. This was the big Dick Lugar for President campaign. Senator Dick Lugar from Indiana, he was running for president back in 1996. And it was interesting, he was a national security expert, and he was one of the first people to really talk openly about domestic terrorism. He was talking about it before the Oklahoma City bombing. He was talking about it certainly before 9/11. And what put his campaign on the map was actually he did a very low-budget ad. We used campaign staff to put the ad together, but it was talking about a suitcase bomb, which at the time no one had really thought about outside of maybe some science fiction writers and whatnot. But he was a visionary when it came to the importance of national security. He also did a lot of important work on tax reform, as well as a big agriculture guy as well from the Midwest. But so I started volunteering on his campaign back in 1996. I drove my 1985 Type 10 Chevrolet Cavalier from Davie County, North Carolina, up to New Hampshire. The muffler was not really attached by the time I got to New Hampshire, but we made it work anyway. And started jumping out of moving vans, throwing up yard signs as quick as I could, knocking on doors, and doing basically anything anyone asked of me.
Interesting. And Richard Lugar, Dick Lugar, longtime senator from Indiana, I believe he died. He died about a year ago, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's last year. I think right about this time now that you mentioned it.
You also, I read you worked for a little bit more than a year as a resident program officer in Kabul, Afghanistan. And the role there, if I've got it right, is you trained local candidates and civil society advocates. What does training a local, I'm presuming this is a political candidate, what does training a local political candidate in Afghanistan consist of?
Well, watching your back very carefully, that's always a good first step. But after the Bush administration, I wound up doing a road trip around the country, catching up with a lot of old friends who I'd sort of lost touch with. I was a little bit burned out after the hours you keep at the White House. But during that time, I got an email from a friend saying they needed someone to go to Afghanistan. The organization was called the International Republican Institute. It's got a partisan name, but a very nonpartisan mission. And this all comes out of, actually, it comes from the Carter administration started something called the National Endowment for Democracy. It was a very small program. And the Reagan administration, when they came in, to their credit, they said, oh, this is a Carter initiative, but you know what? This is a smart policy, a smart idea. It was born out of the idea that just because you take out the bad guys in some of these third-party countries, the good guys might not know exactly what they need to do, what they're trying to do. And so I got this email saying they needed someone to go to Afghanistan. At the time, I was still single, had no mortgage, you know, no mortgage, no marriage, no kids, nothing really tying me down. And in my case, you know, the Afghanistan legacy was such a big part of the Bush administration, you know, not by our choosing, but by the way things played out. And so it was I was too old to join the military, didn't really have any way I felt like I could contribute. And then lo and behold, here's this way I could contribute. And so I said, well, I would be interested. And one thing led to another. I found myself actually almost 10 years and 1 week to the day shipping out to Afghanistan. And so what we did over there was we were literally working with candidates, teaching them how to run for office. And so we had a house. There was no green zone in Afghanistan the way there was in Baghdad. So we had a house on one side of the street. We had another house on the other side of the street. And the other house was the training facility. But every day I worked with about 25 Afghans who worked with us, like our partners on the ground there in Afghanistan. We were not allowed to travel around the country. And so a lot of times our Afghan partners, they would travel for us and take what we had taught them. We called it training the trainers. So we would train them how to train other people how to run for office. But also, too, we would have a lot of folks come from all over the country, all the provinces across Afghanistan into town for teaching. And, you know, there's two different languages in Afghanistan. So we could only have one language at a time. Occasionally, I would have a class that had both languages in there. And so you would talk for 30 seconds, then wait for your translator to translate one language, wait for another translator to translate the other language. And so it was a slow and laborious process, but it was really fascinating. Though I mean, you're watching these stone faces. They're just looking back at you. they're all sort of scowling at you, and they're not mad. They're just concentrating really hard and just thinking this through and just, you know, analyzing it in their own way. And all of a sudden, you can almost see the light bulb go off when you made a connection and helped them understand some aspect of campaigning. And so it was, I'm not going to say, I think I trained around 450 candidates. I'm not going to say all 450 learned something, but I think we did have a positive impact with some of them.
All right, let me do this. I appreciate you being as generous with your time as you have been, but I'll get you out of here with three quick ones. What is your political dream job?
You know, honestly, I've had my political dream job. I literally one time in college had to write up, you know, what I wanted to do and what I really, as my fantasy job. And what I wanted to write about was being White House political director. And instead, I wrote about being an aide to Governor Richard Petty, who at the time was looking at running for Secretary of State, which he eventually did. But I just didn't think it would be possible to work in the White House. I didn't have any connections, didn't see any way to make it there. And I got to live my dream. And so I've had my political dream job. At this point in my life, I've got two little boys who I probably don't spend enough time with already. And so the time commitment that working full-time in politics takes, it's something that I'm not to have a hard time balancing that with the challenges of parenthood and everything. So I'm lucky in that I've had my dream job.
What do you do to take a true, sincere break from politics?
I took about a 7.5 month road trip after the White House days. I did 23 baseball stadiums, I believe 9 presidential libraries, which might not be a break from politics. About 14 national parks or so, and so I did a pretty hard separation there. But I always try to have one fiction book going and one nonfiction book going. I tend to get through the fiction a lot faster, so I guess that's my escape is spy thrillers and whatnot. But then otherwise, it's a lot of time with the kids, whether it be hiking or like I said, Maxwell's getting real good with his biking daredevil ways these days.
There you go. I grew up outside of Boston as well, so Fenway is probably mine as well. Last one for me is, what office will Pat McCrory run for next?
Well, you know, I've not talked to the governor in quite some time, but based on some of his social media posting and based on some of his radio commentary and whatnot, he's definitely staying very active in conservative circles. And so he has publicly stated he has a real interest in the U.S. Senate. And so I think it's very likely he might look at running for U.S. Senate in 2022.
Fair enough. We'll leave it there for now. You can follow him on Twitter at Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Feltz, F-E-L-T-S. He's a political strategist and has worn many different hats in the North Carolina and Washington political spheres. Jonathan, I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Jeff.
You've heard me say it before, but we are appreciative and glad to have you along for the WUNC Politics Podcast. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Spotify if you are not already subscribing to the program. And if you enjoy what you hear, consider passing it along to a family member, a friend, a colleague, a neighbor, somebody that you're video chatting with here during the pandemic. And as a reminder, on Friday, you'll get the next episode of the WUNC Politics Podcast when Rob Schofield and Becky Gray break down some of what happened in state politics in the preceding days. For Jonathan Feltz, I'm Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again soon.